2007 draws to a close. We thank you for supporting WILL. There's still time to make a tax-deductible donation now to ensure the public radio, television, and online service you rely on will continue to thrive in 2008. I'm radio station manager Jay Pierce. Help us reach our December 31st fundraising goal of $920,000. Call 217-244-9455 or log on to willpledge.org. Thanks.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department offers box lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Delivery is available at 239-5632. Strawberry Fields also offers an in-store nutritionist.
I don't get it.
What?
Something like half the people on the planet are overweight or obese, right?
Well, I don't think it's that much, but obesity is a problem.
So anyway, what I don't get is why we don't just put more money into educating people about healthy eating. If people knew more about the health risks associated with obesity, they'd probably eat better.
But this year, the U.S. federal government will spend over $1 billion teaching kids about healthy eating.
Great.
Maybe. But an Associated Press review of over 50 school-based nutrition programs found that they mostly fail. It seems that no matter how much teachers talk to kids about eating fruits and vegetables, it doesn't make much of a difference in what they actually eat.
But why?
Nobody knows. I guess there's a big difference between knowing that eating vegetables is healthy and actually doing it. And there are just so many factors that contribute to obesity. Genetics, family eating habits, lack of exercise.
Does this mean that nutrition education is pointless?
Not at all. It could be that we just haven't found the right way to get the message across. Maybe the key is changing not only people's attitudes toward food, but their actual behavior.
Which is really hard to do.
Exactly. The frustrating thing is that we know how to curb obesity, eat less, and exercise more. It's simple in theory, but getting people to actually do it is a problem that scientists haven't solved.
This moment of science comes from Indiana University.
Today's program was prepared by Jeremy Shear with help from Thomas Baranowski at the Baylor College of Medicine, Houston.
There are hundreds more moments of science on our website at amos.indiana.edu. To get podcasts, click on the podcast button. Once again, our web address, amos.indiana.edu. And for podcasts, click on the podcast button. For a moment of science, I'm Don Glass.
And I'm Yael Cassander.
There's an NFL game this evening in Landover, Maryland, as Washington entertains Chicago. Despite the fact each club is 5-7 on the season, both are still alive in the NFC playoff picture. Jim Grobe is going to return as head football coach at Wake Forest. There had been speculation that he might jump ship for the vacancy at Arkansas. Wake Forest athletic director Ron Wellman made the announcement that Grobe is staying put. Baseball's winter meetings are coming to a close today in Nashville, Tennessee. Earlier today, the Kansas City Royals confirmed that they have acquired the services of free agent Jose Guillen. And the Chicago Cubs today acquired right-handed pitcher Tim Leahy from the Tampa Bay Rays in exchange for cash considerations. Leahy was drafted as a catcher in the 20th round of the 2004 draft and was converted to a pitcher beginning with the 2005 season. He's 15-6 over his career so far with a 3.91 ERA and 38 saves in 123 minor league relief appearances. This evening's men's top 25 college basketball game is one game. 13th-ranked Butler faces Detroit, while 25th-ranked Villanova is playing LSU at the Wachovia Center in Philadelphia. So actually, it is a light schedule. There are two games in top 25 men's college basketball tonight. That's sports.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, featuring free performances by the U of I Black Chorus, Nathaniel Banks and Friends, the U of I Latin Jazz Band, and Tonic Sofa in 2008. More information is available at KrannertCenter.com.
It's 2:45. A new employment program is tying the need low-income people have for good-paying work to the imperative of meeting the nation's growing energy demands. The Green Jobs Movement trains out-of-work people, former blue-collar workers, to install solar, wind, and other alternative energy systems at home and at businesses. Christy Cole reports what started as a local program might soon be coming to the rest of the nation.
Can you grab the bolts, Tim, please?
Oh, you got the screws?
It's a sweltering sunny day, one when people are encouraged to reduce their energy use. And so it's fitting that a small group of young adults is busily installing solar panels on the roof of a house. People honk their car horns as they drive past this house. Solar power is supported here in California. The workers on the rooftop stop to cheer, clap, and pump their fists in response. The atmosphere here is electric, and that's to be expected because these young trainees, like Andre Collins, are the embodiment of a vision, one that takes low-income people, often people of color, and trains them to work in the fast-growing alternative energy industry.
They're green jobs because they're healthy and they're right for the people and the environment. And they're green also because they're taking the people who would otherwise be poor and putting green in their pockets. So it's a good lucrative.
Andre Collins is one of 15 people who are completing a 9-week training program in solar panel installation. This program is run by Grid Alternatives, a nonprofit that installs solar in low-income communities. Grid uses volunteers recruited by local youth employment and job training organizations. This installation is a graduation of sorts, and so these trainees are thinking about the job market.
And I'm just proud to be a part of this, and I can't wait to make money.
Some nonprofits are stepping up to make training programs like this possible. So are cities. The City Council in Oakland, California, approved $250,000 for such a program, a sum that's possible thanks to a settlement between energy companies and the state of California. 6 years ago, when rolling blackouts hit California, companies such as Enron raised their rates. While Enron and others didn't admit to any wrongdoing, they gave the state $1 billion. Some of that money is being used to train lower-income people in what's come to be known as green jobs, installing solar panels and tankless hot water heaters, converting vegetable oil to fuel. Renewable energy industries are worth big money, already $40 billion a year worldwide. These new industries hold the promise of putting tens of thousands of people to work in the U.S. Van Jones is president of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. He says support for green jobs is redefining the environmental movement.
A social uplift environmentalism that, is less about the Birkenstocks and the tofu, although that stuff is all beautiful, but it's more about the hard hat, the lunch bucket, more of a working class, we can do it environmentalism, I think, is the next step in the environmental revolution.
Jones is leading that revolution in cities like his hometown of Oakland, which has fallen on hard times. Jones says what's missing in struggling blue-collar cities like Oakland are good-paying, skilled labor jobs, jobs that used to come through unions.
And it's time to really rebuild the labor movement, we think, with the new face of working-class America, which is, more Latino, more Black, more Asian, and also with the new consciousness around doing things in an ecologically smart way.
Oakland is the first city to declare a Green Jobs Corps, but there could be many more. Cities across the country might get a chance to start their own programs thanks to pending federal legislation.
This bill will allow for 3 million workers here to be able to enjoy this kind of training and advancement.
That's California Congresswoman Hilda Solis describing a bill she's authored in a YouTube video. The Green Jobs Act of 2007 proposes to dedicate $500 million to train people to do green-collar work. This fall, the U.S. Senate will take up Solis's bill. Many believe creating green jobs will not only revitalize the economy and the environment, but also reinsert something that has long been missing from these communities, hope. For the Environment Report, I'm Christy Cole.
Retail groups say consumers will purchase nearly one-third of their holiday gifts online this year. Using your computer to shop might help you beat high gas prices and pollute less, Chuck Kornbeck reports.
Ordering items online usually means less driving around to retail outlets, and at the price of gas, your savings can add up. But online orders often mean a delivery truck still has to bring you a product. Brian Welch of the website earthmoment.com says you can even cut the delivery company's costs and vehicle pollution by having items sent to your workplace.
If you work in an office, in all likelihood, there are several deliveries a day to that office already. So there's no incremental energy used to deliver one more little box to you at the office.
Earth Moment is owned by Ogden Publications. It's also running a program where money from some online purchases goes to reforestation projects and other means of offsetting greenhouse gas emissions. For the Environment Report, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
The Environment Report is a production of Michigan Radio. Support comes from the Joyce Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and USDA's Cooperative Extension Service. Have something to say about the Environment Report? Send email to feedback@environmentreport.org.
The lighting of the National Christmas Tree takes place tonight in Washington, D.C., presided over by the President and the First Lady. The very first lighting of a public Christmas tree in the U.S. was presided over by the Mayor of Boston, John Fitzgerald. He's the grandfather of another president, John F. Kennedy, and the great-grandfather of Carolyn Kennedy. Carolyn Kennedy has now compiled a new Christmas anthology, A Family Christmas. It's a collection of poetry, prose, lyrics, and scripture about the season. Carolyn Kennedy spoke with NPR Morning Edition host Renee Montaigne about the anthology.
You had a moment as you were researching this book when your great-grandfather's role in that tradition was called into question, for you anyway.
Well, I had always heard the story growing up that it was the first public Christmas tree in Boston. And I, of course, assumed that meant it was the first public Christmas tree in America because Boston's always first in our family. And then when I was researching, lots of articles all talk about how the first public Christmas tree was in New York. And it made me very, very nervous because it was something that was something my whole family has been so proud of. So I couldn't handle the fact that I would be responsible for blowing open the cover on Honey Fitz. But he came through with flying colors, and he lit the first Christmas tree in Boston Common half an hour before the first Christmas tree in New York City. So wonderful and very happy family end to this celebration and this tale.
Now, the very first thing in the book is a letter that you wrote to Santa Claus back in 1962. You were 5 years old. It is such a tradition for little kids to write letters to Santa Claus. Read your little letter.
Dear Santa, I would like a pair of silver skates and Susie Smart and Candy fashion dolls and a real pet reindeer and a clock to tell time and a covered wagon and a farm, and you decide anything else. And interesting planes or bumpy things he can ride in or some noisy thing or something he can push or pull for John. Love from Caroline. P.S. I would like a basket for my bicycle.
These little negotiations.
Yeah, by the way. Well, I think I should add something at the end that I probably have a chance of getting.
But it was quite sweet that you were asking on behalf of your little brother.
I was pretty impressed with that, too. You know, so I definitely wanted to put it in the book. But I think
you'd forgotten how generous you were as a five-year-old.
Yeah.
Well, you know, of course, the list wasn't as long and wasn't as crass as I guess some or certainly people think lists today with video games and whatnot get way away from the spirit of the holiday. Still, toys, that's what you're asking for. But you write that your mother, Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, that your mother believed an orange and some walnuts were great gifts for kids. And this is back in the 60s, so, you know, that was pretty out even then.
I know. Well, she had a rather old-fashioned approach to this kind of thing. And actually, one of the things that we still make of those, when you stick the cloves into the oranges and make those scented pomander balls, I think they're called. Things like that were a big part of our Christmas, and John and I at least thought this was just an atrocious way to celebrate the holiday.
When it came to your own kids, did you in fact carry on those traditions that your
mother? Of course.
Mother?
Of course. Yeah. And I got the same response from them. walnuts, what is this doing in my stocking? But I think the continuity really of the traditions is really what makes Christmas so special. And for me, seeing my children do the same kinds of things that I did when I was young, and even that my mother did for her mother, all of that is just so powerful when you have kids and when you see that continuing forward.
You have one section of the book that's devoted to Christmas in wartime.
Well, I thought it was important to include Christmas in wartime because going back to Isaiah and in the New Testament, St. Luke, you know, the coming of the Messiah really represents the hope for peace. And so the idea that of war happening at this time of year when people are just yearning for peace is obviously such a painful contrast, certainly for the families of people who are separated. And the history also is intertwined with our country, the Civil War, and was really the time when Santa and Christmas kind of took hold and became more widespread. But even going back earlier, George Washington crossed the Delaware on Christmas Day. And then you get to World War I, where the soldiers in the trenches in World War I just spontaneously stopped fighting and came out of the trenches and sang to each other across the dividing line. And they came out, they exchanged handshakes, they exchanged tobacco, they collected the wounded. And it's really an amazing, I think, episode in war that really speaks to the spirit of Christmas.
At the very end of the book, there's a reflection on Christmas by the essayist E.B. White. And in that, he offers a moment that could sum up the spirit of the holiday. Tell us about that.
Well, he wrote an annual, message for many of the years that he was at the New Yorker. And this one is about struggling with trying to say something new and different about Christmas. And then he remembers having lunch with an aunt of his who was 92 and who had grown up in a world that was slower paced and more formal. And he was having lunch with her in the autumn, and he apologized for not taking her out on a drive to look at the changing leaves. And she said without hesitating, "Why, my dear, remembrance is sufficient of the beauty we have seen." He applies that to Christmas, and I think really speaks to the power of memory and tradition as we grow up over the years, and then we are able to look back on the Christmases that we've experienced with people we love who may or may not still be with us, and the power of those memories.
Caroline Kennedy spoke about her new book, A Family Christmas, a collection of writings about the meaning, the traditions, and the humor of the season, with NPR's Renee Montaigne.
Earth and Sky.
This is Joel Block. An orchestra of insect musicians awaits those with ears to listen. Here's more with Earth and Sky's Jorge Salazar.
Thanks, Joel. I spoke with Lang Elliott, co-author of The Songs of Insects, a book and CD on the trills and chirps of the outdoors. Elliott said these sounds are primarily made by males calling out to females, saying, "I'm here for you." Katydids and crickets chirp to their sweethearts by what Elliott called stridulation.
They're rubbing their wings together. At the base of one wing, there's a file. At the base of the opposite wing, there's a scraper. So the scraper is rubbed over the file, or vice versa, to set up a vibration, which is amplified in part by the wings.
Meanwhile, cicadas produce their songs with drum-like organs called timbals.
The cicadas, their ears are right next to their timbals at the base of their antennae. Seems like they drive themselves insane when they're singing.
Elliott added that sometimes within a species, male insects will come together to form a choir.
They're clearly coming together. They're attracted. Males will hear these congregations and walk toward them, and I've often found that, like katydids crossing the roads because they're heading for these choruses.
Lang Elliott speaking with Jorge Salazar on Insect Songs. We're Earth and Sky, a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston, Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. There are no substitutes for donated blood. It takes 45 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. Blood donation. It's about life.
This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. A snow advisory is in effect for the entire WILL severe weather coverage area, including Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, DeWitt, Douglas, Edgar, Ford, Iroquois, Livingston, Logan, Macon, McLean, Moultrie, Piatt, Sangamon, Shelby, and Vermilion counties from 6 p.m. this evening through 6 a.m. tomorrow for a general snowfall of 2 to 4 inches. Ed Kieser's forecast for Illinois and Indiana tonight, north and central, cloudy with snow overspreading the area from west to east, with many locations receiving accumulations of 2 to 4 inches. In the south, cloudy with rain showers arriving with with some sleet on the northern fringe, lows ranging from 24 north to 34 far south. The outlook for tomorrow, north and central, mostly cloudy with some lingering flurries early. In the south, tomorrow cloudy with scattered rain showers, highs ranging from 25 in northwestern Illinois to 47 in the far south. Coming up next here on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu, it's The World from PRI. Stay tuned.